For many of us, summer in Maryland kicks off with Memorial Day weekend. Thousands migrate to the beaches for a long weekend of sun and fun. Others host cookouts in their backyards, maybe even take the covers off their pools for the first time of the season. And some of us gather our mallets and our seasonings of choice for what's become a truly sacred tradition in this close-knit community of a state, the Summer Crab Feast. This is Roughly Speaking Newsroom Edition, the flagship podcast of the Baltimore Sun, featuring stories from our city and our state that you can't get anywhere else. I'm Pamela Wood. Thank you for joining us. On today's episode, we welcome Baltimore Sun reporter Scott Dance to our sound studio. Scott covers science, weather, and the environment for us, and he's kept a keen and watchful eye on the Chesapeake Bay and the many critters that call it home over the years. And he also keeps track of other climate irregularities in the state that have become something of a norm. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, yeah.
So, Scott, let's start off by talking about the health of the Chesapeake Bay. We just got a new report card this week from the University of Maryland. What does it tell us about the health of the bay?
Yeah, so it wasn't a huge surprise. It told us that the bay's health took a hit in 2018, and that was largely because of all the rain that we had. You know, almost 72 inches of rain at BWI. That's like almost twice what we get in a normal year. And that's bad for the bay because it washes in more of the junk that we leave, you know, on farm fields, on sidewalks and gutters and all of that. So, you know, we had higher levels of nitrogen and phosphorus, which are important to look at in terms of the bay's ecology, because they can sort of throw the ecology off by creating these algae blooms and clouding the water. And, you know, it's just generally not good for the natural ecosystem to have this influx of what we call nutrients into the water. And then, of course, there's also trash. There's, you know, lots of other stuff. So, yeah, it was not a great year. But the point that the scientists made was that the bay is still on an improving trajectory. Because the bay has recovered so much in recent years, it was able to sort of withstand this onslaught of rainfall and nutrients and other pollution better than it might have, you know, taken a similar surge of rain 10 years ago or something. So, like, you know, we did see increases in nitrogen and phosphorus, decreases in like underwater grasses and different types of aquatic life. But, you know, the main word that the scientists use is resilience. They were like, you know, the bay took a hit, but it was resilient.
So even though the grades are a little lower this year, scientists think that the work that's been going on for decades now, that is making some progress, that is bearing fruit?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess it's a little tricky to, like, sort of, you know, figure out what efforts lead to what. You know, it's hard to, like, assign credit to specific things. But they're just saying, yeah, overall, since we've been, you know, more mindful of what we are letting wash into the bay and, you know, been creating public policies that reflect that, the bay's health has been improving. So we got a C grade this year, same as we've gotten for the past several years. It was like a slightly lower C than usual, but it was still a C. So, you know, that means, you know, we're doing okay, but obviously still plenty of room for improvement. So that, yeah, that's also always their message also is that, you know, we can't let up. We need to, this shows that we need to maintain this progress and go even further.
And now we have all the states surrounding the bay and the local governments working together with the federal government on this partnership to restore the Chesapeake Bay. And here in Maryland, obviously, we have deep interest in the health of the bay. The White House, maybe not so much. Can you tell me what President Trump has proposed in terms of funding and his budgets for this multi-state effort?
Yeah. So this year, as he has done pretty much every year since he's come into office, President Trump and his administration have proposed, you know, basically eliminating the Chesapeake Bay program, which is a federal state partnership, you know, involves Maryland, but also the other states in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, you know, mainly Virginia, Pennsylvania, you know, to a lesser extent, Delaware, New York. And so, yeah, the politicians have repeatedly sort of fought this off. You know, the way that federal budgeting works, they don't really like just adopt the budget that he proposes. So they've been able to sort of get around this and, you know, it hasn't been imposed, but it's reason for concern, you know, that environmentalists point to, saying, look, this administration's not prioritizing this program or this cleanup, and the federal aspect of it is important because Maryland can't force any other state to do anything to clean up, you know, what's washing down the Susquehanna River, for example. So this, you know, having a federal partner that can point, go to these other states and hold them to these goals that each state has for reducing, you know, say, fertilizer levels on farm fields. They call it this backstop that, you know, the federal government ensures that every state is doing their part to reduce what's washing into the bay.
Right, because, you know, here in Maryland and our neighbors to the south in Virginia, we can see the bay and touch the bay and see the impact. But, you know, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Delaware, New York, they all flow into the bay as well. And that's, yeah, as they say, backstopping, that's really where that federal government can come in with a hammer on them if needed.
Yeah, and in Maryland, you know, politicians can score a lot of political points by campaigning on their, you know, their love for the bay and their defense of the bay. But like in Pennsylvania or New York, people don't care. No one's going to vote for you
right.
for that. But obviously they, you know, those areas still have a big impact on the health of the bay. So that's why this program is important. Governor Hogan and, you know, Senators Cardin and Van Hollen and, you know, everybody really in Maryland's delegation on Capitol Hill have really stood up and said, we're going to defend this. It's a $73 million federal program. It's based in Annapolis, so people in Annapolis feel a lot of close ties to it. So, yeah, so far it's holding strong despite this, you know, these repeated proposals from the Trump administration.
And it's really interesting to me because $73 million sounds like a lot of money to folks like you and me, but in the grand scheme of the entire federal budget or even within the EPA's budget that it's funded from, like, that's actually not that much money at all for a big impact in our region.
Yeah, and the EPA administrator, the new one, Andrew Wheeler, has said, you know, I support this program, even though it's gotten this, you know, weird, you know, deletion from the budget. So kind of hard to say how the EPA and the federal government really feel about this program. But yeah, in Maryland, certainly it's very important.
So now let's turn to blue crabs, everybody's favorite crustacean in the Chesapeake Bay. Memorial Day brings the start of crab feast season. What's the latest outlook for the blue crab population? What are the scientists saying?
Yeah, so just recently they put out some promising numbers as far as, yeah, what they saw in a survey that they do every winter where they dredge up crabs that are hibernating in the mud for the winter and they count them and, you know, tally them all up and then estimate, you know, what that means for the whole bay. And so, yeah, it was the bay's crab population is at the largest it's been in 7 years.
That sounds like good news.
Yeah. And the number of juveniles basically double over what it was this, you know, this time last year. And last year was a little bit of a down year. There's always a lot of fluctuation because the way that crabs reproduce and migrate, there's lots of ways nature can sort of limit or grow the number of crabs that make it into the bay every year. They depend on like tides and winds and weather and temperatures, all of that. So this year, yeah, this winter was relatively mild or just like reasonably, you know, not too cold. And so they did pretty well. And so, yeah, the number of juveniles is up, which means, you know, good things for late in the season when those crabs grow large enough to be legally caught.
So can I go out and buy and eat crabs this year, like with a good conscience?
Yeah, I mean, you always can because they, you know, there's lots of rules in place. I mean, yeah, I guess restraint is always good for the population. But yeah, no, people are always going to eat crabs. And yeah, so they can only catch them of certain size. They, you know, with females, they can only catch a certain number of them. And the number of females is also up. Spawning females is also up this year. So I think 29%. So yeah, it's going to be a decent season for watermen, I think.
As long as, of course, the, you know, the weather, you know, complies and they can,
yeah,
you know, get out there and catch them.
That can always change. Yeah, when it gets too hot, they say, oh, the crabs aren't moving. It's just too hot. They're just, you know, laying low and I can't get any of them.
Or if it's too cold, the same,
yeah,
thing.
Right,
you can't,
right,
get them.
It's like you can never get it quite right. But at least, yeah, they've got a good starting place this year.
So one of the ways that a lot of folks like to eat crabs is, you know, crab dip, crab cakes. You know, we get picked crab meat in containers. And over the years, the crab picking houses on the Eastern Shore have been challenged in getting the visas for the foreign workers who come here and pick the crabs. They're H-2B visas. What is the latest status of those visas?
Yeah. A year ago this time, it was pretty dire straits, and a lot of the crab houses on the Eastern Shore where they hire these foreign workers, mostly from Mexico, to pick crabs and, you know, sell them in tubs at the grocery store or to restaurants or whatever. About a third of them were like not going to have any workers at all because there's such high demand for this type of visa, which is like not just for the crab industry, but is also for, you know, landscapers or other seasonal work that's not exactly agriculture. Agriculture has a separate program. But so this shortage meant that a lot of crab houses on the Eastern Shore that, you know, pick these crabs and sell tubs of meat to grocery stores or restaurants or whatever, didn't have any workers at all. And so that was kind of a crisis. So in response to that, the Trump administration has released an additional 30,000 visas, which is like double what was available before for this part of the year. And so, yeah, they're in pretty good shape. I mean, we haven't heard about any, you know, real issues. You know, there's nobody like they were last year saying we don't have any workers. We don't know what we're going to do. I mean, it's still not a perfect system, I think they would say. You know, they still have to be super quick every January to apply for these visas, and, you know, requires them to really plan ahead a lot. It's a lot of paperwork, big headache. But, you know, it runs this industry that you know, is kind of all there is in some of these Eastern Shore and Southern Maryland communities. And it's way smaller than it used to be even. So, yeah, it's in, again, better shape than it was last year, but still, you know, something to watch.
And now the reason why these crab picking houses need the visas for the foreign workers is because they have a difficult time staffing these crab houses with local workers, with Americans, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, historically, this work was done by like the wives and daughters of, you know, the watermen. But now, you know, it's just people don't want to do this work. You know, Marylanders don't want to do this work. They don't want their kids to do this work. They want to send them off to college. And, you know, the women have other jobs, or, you know, it's the economy has just changed a lot. So as a result, yeah, they hire mostly workers from Mexico to do this. It's a super tedious work, as anyone who's ever, you know, picked a crab knows. And, you know, these workers have it really down to a science, and, you know, they're sometimes paid by the pound, you know, by that production level, like how fast can they pick how, you know, this number of crabs. And so it's a crazy industry, but it's also one where, unlike a lot of other industries, it's very difficult to adapt it to technology. They've tried to figure out ways to use robotics and things like that to pick crabs and, you know, just cut people out of the equation entirely, but it's just not really possible yet.
It's hard to picture like some sort of machine like successfully picking apart a crab and, you know, not wasting any meat or just demolishing it.
Yeah, right. That's the problem. Like, it's so delicate, and like there's so many, you know, nooks and crannies where all the meat is, as anybody who, you know, has ever had a crab feast knows. Like, everybody has their way of doing it, and you know, these workers, I guess, have figured out the best way of doing it. I don't know exactly. I guess they all have their own tricks, but you know, like everybody does. So
I've seen them before at those crab picking houses on the shore, and they're absolutely amazing. And I think of how, you know, it's one thing when you're just sitting around having a few crabs, but to try and do it like on the clock and get a bunch done, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about eating crabs, which is the fun part. So you and I are both Marylanders, the veterans of many a crab feast. Since you know a lot about crabs, what should people be looking for, or how do people go about like buying good crabs for their crab feast?
I mean, yeah, everybody has their, I guess, favorite spot. I feel like, you know, you buy from a place once, you get some good crabs, you go back there. So I would say in general, like, yeah, if it's a popular place, that's certainly a good sign. But just like anything else you're eating, you know, you just, does it look right? Does it smell right? Although maybe people who aren't used to picking crabs might not know that when you do open up a crab, it doesn't look quite, you know, appetizing at first. So maybe know to expect that a little bit. Expect, you know, some of this mustard and other gunk that gets up
right
in there.
The gills.
Yeah.
Yeah, it can be kind of terrifying for somebody who's not picked a crab before. Do you have any like tips or techniques how you pick your crabs?
I mean,
do you use a mallet?
I do, mostly just for the claws. I would say I go claws and legs first.
Same.
But I'm not very good at like actually getting the meat out on like on the leg. Like trying to pull out the inside meat, like so still to be, attached to the leg.
You have to be lucky, I think. Yeah, yeah. To get that.
Right. And well, and like the back fin, like that's maybe the easiest and also the most rewarding.
Yes.
to get that huge lump out.
Especially if it's like a heavy crab.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
If it's real dense.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I open it up from there and, you know, take out what's left over. But yeah. But so for the claws, like I've never been good at breaking off the smaller part of the claw and mm-hmm. like getting into it that way. So I just like take a knife to the middle of it and bludgeon yeah. away with the mallet. Yeah.
So yeah, my spouse claims he's a true Baltimorean and he would never use a mallet. So he like doesn't allow them. Huh. But I do the same. I use a knife and then either with a mallet or like the back of my hand to crack that crab open.
Yeah, yeah.
But with mallets, this is the thing that always terrifies me. You see it on TV, somebody setting the crab down and taking the mallet and like whacking the back of the shell.
To the middle, yeah.
Yeah, that just...
No.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like nature,
that,
nature has provided a way to easily split the you know, the main shells, like the shell off the top of the body, like... Just do that, and, yeah. and you'll be good.
And any crab place, will show you if you've never done it before. I was at a place in St. Michael's where they actually had placemats that showed the steps
helpful.
To do it.
Yeah.
And they were showing people. So, anything you like to have along with your crabs?
I mean, to me, the best thing is just like a natty boat or similar beer.
Something light.
Yeah.
Easy drinking.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't go with any, you know, butter or other sort of condiments. Like I just, you know, the seasoning on the crab, you know, you just try to, if the meat doesn't have much on it, you know, rub it on the outside of the shell or something, get some of that on there and yeah, that makes it taste great.
Same. That's exactly how I do it. Yeah. No butter either in my house.
No, yeah. And I've never been like a real lobster eater. Like, I mean, obviously, because I'm from Maryland and not Maine, I don't really eat lobster. But I don't really understand like why people have taken that butter thing from lobster eating and like translated it to think that they would use that for a crab. But I don't know. People can write into us and tell us different, I guess. But I don't, to me, like using butter, that's a Maine lobster thing. Like,
it's not a Maryland crab thing.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, I don't get that. So, well, however you folks eat your crabs, I hope everybody enjoys them. Scott, thank you for joining us and talking about the Chesapeake Bay and crabs. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that wraps up this week's Newsroom Edition. Thank you for joining us. For more audio from the Baltimore Sun, head on over to baltimoresun.com/roughlyspeaking or wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to check us out every Friday. And as we say each week, as times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't. So please consider subscribing to the Baltimore Sun at baltimoresun.com/subscribe. For producers Hallie Miller and Steve Early, thank you again, and we'll see you back here next week.